As you have already noticed, we're not going through the book of Job verse by verse, meticulously going through the text. We're trying to stay a little higher than that. And it's already the first of the second month in the quarter, so our pace will have to pick up just a little bit for us to get done by the end of next month. And the lessons, starting with this one, that they're passing out in the coming lessons, they'll be covering more or bigger sections of the text. So as long as we get the main idea of the book, verse-by-verse studies are good, but sometimes we just don't have time to do that, and I think this is one of those times. All right, we're on page 10 in your handouts, and Job chapter 9. We're in the middle of these speeches or these exchanges, these dialogues. And we're going to finish up Bildad. Real quickly, Bildad's... actually, we're finishing up Job's response to Bildad. We're on about question... somewhere between question 7 and 8 is where we got to last Sunday. Of course, we didn't have class this past Wednesday because of our singing. But this is where we left off. We'll do just a quick review. His argument, not much different than Eliphaz's argument. They're all saying the same thing, really. Just sometimes their tactics are a little different, but the basic message is the same. Accusing Job of being blind to his own sin. Bildad made three harsh insinuations or implications about Job's position. Insinuated that Job's children were dead because they were guilty. And he also insinuated that Job needs to seek God. And then if Job was pure and upright, which implying he's not, then God would certainly bless him and make his end better than his beginning. So we covered all that last Sunday. The argument that Bildad made was based on the wisdom of the ancients. And he said these three things, which are statically true. I mean, on paper, they are true. But the problem he was misapplying these truths to Job's situation, which they were not true in that sense. But life without God is like papyrus without water. There's no future there. And he went through all that. So the basic message was to Job, you need to repent. And again, that's what Eliphaz said, that's what Bildad has said, that's what Zophar will say. There's no difference in all that. So now Job begins to respond, and he initially agrees with the friends that, yes, man doesn't deserve to stand before God, but what is it that Job wants from God at this moment? And he will continue to want this throughout his speeches. He wants a reason. He wants God to tell him why all this bad has happened. So he's wanting this meeting, this audience with God. That's what he wants. He still desires answers for his situation. And he then begins to expound upon the power of God. This is verses 14 through 24 of chapter 9. And Job complains of unfair treatment. You can see in those 11 verses in the chapter, Job makes some statements that are not wise. He says in verse 17 that God multiplies my wounds without cause. Though I am guiltless, he will declare me guilty, verse 20. So Job is speaking out of his suffering. And we concluded at the first half of verse 24 when he says, if it's not God doing all this, then tell me who it is. Now, I don't see any other reason for this. This is God putting it on me. And if it's not Him, well, then who is it? Well, that's how Job saw it. And this is where we left off last Sunday. So now picking up verses 25 to 26, Job returns to a lament of life's brevity. You'll see there in those two verses, my days are swifter than a runner. And they flee away, they see no good, they slip by like reed boats, like an eagle that swoops on its prey. So Job sees his life on the fast track, and of course it's headed to a very undesirable end. But that's how he felt at this particular moment. And he fears not speaking. If I do not speak out and voice my anguish and make known how this makes me feel, so to speak, then he's afraid that if he just sits there in silence and suffers, then his suffering will overwhelm him and he'll just shrivel away to nothing. And he'll be presumed guilty by other people. So Job feels compelled to keep saying, I don't deserve this. I am not guilty. Especially when these three people are saying to him, now Job, you've done something terribly wicked here, and this is why God is punishing you. So he has no hope of being acquitted. Verses 29 through 31, you see there in chapter 9. I am accounted wicked. Why then should I toil in vain? If I should wash myself with snow and cleanse my hands with lye. Verse 31, what does he say that God would do even if he were to do that? That will plunge me where? Into the pit. And my own clothes would abhor me. Now, what Job is really wanting, we'll see there in chapter 9, toward the end of the chapter, what he longs for is an umpire. And your version may not say umpire. The New American Standard does say umpire. Verse 33, are there other mediator? Job wants a mediator between what two parties? Himself and God. Of course, the problem with that is what? A mediator or an umpire will mediate between parties that are typically equal. What's the problem here? They're not equal. And Job understands that, doesn't he? He doesn't have to be taught. Now, Job, God is way up here and you're way down here. Job understands that. But he still wants an audience. He still wants this process worked out where this exchange can happen and he be told why this is happening to him and he respond back why he thinks he doesn't need it. So he longs for this mediator, this umpire. That's what he wants. Notice Job, has Job ever really said, per se, I wish my suffering would end? He's not said that. Now, he said, I wish my life would end. He has said that. He's wanting answers, is what he's wanting. And this meeting, if you will, if we're going to call it a meeting, the Bible doesn't call it that, but that's really what it is, an audience, a meeting. Arbitration, if you will, mediation. So he's longing for this umpire, someone who could mediate between him and God. But because God is not a man as I am, and Job does say that, doesn't he? In verse 32, he is not a man as I am that I may answer him, that we could go to court together and argue this out, debate it out, so to speak. That's not going to happen. Job understands that. So, without an umpire, all Job can do the first part of chapter 10 is just speak out in his grief. He's just going to keep complaining. And I don't mean to use complaining in the sense of a whiner. I'm saying he's just going to continue to speak out in his agony and his anguish and his perplexity in his mind as to why all this is happening. Because I know I can't have this meeting with a mediator between me and God. So Job says, that's the only recourse. I just have to keep talking out my grief. And of course, how'd that make his friends feel? They're going to keep hearing this defense of Job's, and they're going to keep saying, no, Job, that's not the way it is. You're going to have to fess up here and admit that you're guilty. So you see the tactics aren't changing. They have dug their heels in, the three friends have, and they're persistently saying, Job, you're guilty. Well, has not Job also dug his heels in? He has. And he says, I'm not guilty, and I don't deserve being treated this way, and I want some answers why God is doing this to me. Job's convinced this from God. There's no question about that in the text. Job is convinced God is doing this to him. Now, of course, students of the Bible, we know otherwise, don't we? Who's the one doing this? It's Satan's the one doing it. And God has allowed this for the testing of Job's faith, to show Satan that Job will not do what Satan said he would do, which is curse God to his face because of the removal of his blessings and his health. So we see a lot of things at work here. Okay? And some of this, though I'm not sure to the degree of Job's situation, if it would ever happen, it may. But can this kind of thing still happen to us today? Sure can. Absolutely can. And we have to decide how we're going to respond. As you recall, when we introduced the book, the lesson of Job is not that man suffers. That's not the lesson that we need to take away from it. The lesson that we take away from it is, what does man do in response to his suffering? That's the lesson. How does man handle it? Does he blame God? Does he curse God? Become bitter toward God? Or does he use it to rise above his sufferings and make his faith stronger and he come out tried and true, more perfected in his faith and trust in God. Okay, so Job wants this empire. And it's not going to happen because the parties are not equal. So, in the first part of chapter 10, he speaks, he says, in the bitterness of my soul, agony. And he wants to know why God contends with him and oppresses him. And those are words that he uses, is it not? Verse 2. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why thou dost contend with me. Is it right for thee indeed to oppress, to reject the labor of thy hands? And then he says what? To look favorably on who? The wicked. Now, I'm out here, I have served you, I've lived honorably, and you're contending with me. At the same time, you're looking favorably on those who don't care a thing about you. This was Job's dilemma. He just could not see any rhyme or reason for this. So he asks, why is God contending with me and looking favorably on the wicked? And he also says in verses 6 through 7 that Job was fully aware that God knows whether he has sinned or not. There's never any question in Job's mind about God's omniscience. On that, don't Job and the three friends agree? They've all praised God's omniscience, haven't they? God's ability to rule and control the world and His omniscience and His awareness of everything that man does. The four are in complete agreement on that. They don't need to teach Job that. Job already knows that. And he says so in verses 6 through 7 of chapter 10. Look at verse 7. According to thy knowledge, I am indeed not guilty. So Job admits that God knows the truth about all this. So he seems then to argue. Look in verses 8 through 17 and look particularly at the first part of that section. Thy hands fashioned and made me altogether. And then what's the question he asked? Yeah, did you make me just for the purpose of destroying me? Is that why I've been allowed to live and brought to this point for you now to destroy me? Kind of reminds you of what Joshua said. Remember when the sin of Achan in Joshua chapter 7? After they took Jericho in chapter 6, then chapter 7, unbeknownst to anybody, what had Achan done with respect to the battle of Jericho? And where did he put him? He dug a hole under his tent and buried him in the ground. Well, nobody knew that, did they? And then the next chapter, they sent the patrol out. Well, what's it going to look like at Ai? And it's a big battle. Just send out a small. We don't have to bother everybody. Let's just take a small army up there. 36 men died. You think they knew what had happened? They didn't know what had happened. Joshua begins to lament, and he asked the question in chapter 7 of Joshua. I can't get it exactly, but basically he was crying out to the Lord, why did you bring us out here only to have us destroyed and our enemies blaspheme your great name? That's this kind of question. Has this worked out? Have you done all this good previously just so now the whole thing can fall apart? Well, the answer to that is obviously what? No. That's not how God operates. But that's what Job's thinking. God, I know you fashioned me. You've made me. Was it just for the purpose of destroying me in the end and oppressing me? So he does exalt God as his creator. And he also knows that God takes note of sin. In verse 14, he says, now, if I'm wicked, now, Job has said, I know I'm not. But if I'm wicked, he says, woe to me. I'm going to deserve to be punished if I am wicked. But Job's not confessing sin. He's not giving into that argument. He's just admitting the truth that the sinner does stand guilty before God and deserves to be punished. But Job is not, he's not admitting to that. Look in verses 16 and 17, how he describes God. And should my head be lifted up, thou wouldst hunt me like a lion. And again, thou wouldst show thy power against me. Thou dost renew thy witnesses against me and increase thine anger toward me. Hardship after hardship is within me. Is Job really saying anything new that he's already said? No, it's still the same agony, still the same speaking out of his grief, wanting to know why all this is happening. So as he concludes his response to Bildad, he again laments his birth. He's done that before. Remember in chapter 3? Before the dialogue happened between the friends and Job, Job just offered an opening lament, and he cursed the day of his birth. Wished it never had even happened. I wish it wasn't even on the calendar. And there's an interesting phrase. Look in verse 19. I think this is interesting. Job wished that he had gone from what two points? From the womb to the tomb. Just like that. I wish I never had even lived. If this is all my life's going to be, there's certainly no joy in living this way. I wish I was even dead. So he's returning to this theme, if you will. To the land of darkness, utter gloom, darkness itself. And he again requests that God will withdraw his hand from him. Let me go in the sense that God controls the lives of all men and just let me perish. I don't see any way out of this other than just to die. So Job has now sunk to a pretty low state in his faith, hasn't he? He's not as high as he was. Absolutely. By the time. Satan's wearing on him hard, isn't he? And Job is, he's just, I don't want to use the word venting, but he's just speaking out in his grief. Doesn't know quite what to say. Now, what he has done, he has unfairly questioned and criticized God. He has done that. He has said some things, at least in this speech, in response to Bildad, that were not so. They were not right. Shouldn't be said by one who follows God. He has questioned God's moral control of the universe, especially the couple of times we've seen explicit phrases where he says, "You look favorably upon the wicked, and here I am, and I'm suffering." And basically he's saying, that's not fair. That's just not right. Yes, Charles. Mm-hmm. Okay, that is true. Anticipatory of what Christ can do, there is one God and one man between man and God, the man, Jesus Christ. All right, very good. Very good. Okay, so Job is incorrect in his conclusions, but I think he has evoked our sympathies for him. I'm not giving him a pass because I think the old phrase is true. Words mean something. And whether we write them, whether we say them, we're going to be accountable for what we say. What did Jesus say about every idle word? You're going to give an account for it. So what we do, there are consequences to our actions. And he's not giving a pass in this, but we do see a man, as Brother Tom just observed this, Satan is really wearing on him hard. And he's responding in all this. Hopefully we're learning from him. That's the point. If we just go through the book of Job just for purely academic reasons, I think that's a waste of time. If you go through any book of the Bible, especially from the Old Testament, because what is the New Testament teaching about the Old Testament? It's written for our learning. We have to learn from it. We have to. So we can see Job. Let's let Job teach us about things that are good, but also about things that he did that were not good. We can certainly learn from that. Okay. Now, we get to, this is page 11. And this is lesson 6. And now we look at Zophar. He's going to speak now. He doesn't speak for two chapters like Eliphaz and Bildad did. He just, either he had nothing new to say or he just didn't find the need to speak as much. So only one chapter has his speech. And also, if you've studied Job before or gone through and just quickly surveyed the book, Eliphaz and Bildad will speak three times each. Zophar only speaks twice. He doesn't speak a third time. So again, maybe he has nothing new to add. Maybe he just got fed up with Job and didn't want to reply anymore. We don't know the reason why. We could speculate, but that's not wise to do that. So we just simply observe the fact that Zophar will not say as much in this exchange as his two comrades in these group of three friends. Okay, I would say that of the three, Zophar shows the least amount of tact. He's just blunt. Look what he says in verses 2 and 3, now of chapter 11. Zophar the Naamathite answered, "Shall a multitude of words go unanswered, and a talkative man be acquitted? Shall your boasts silence men, and shall you scoff and none rebuke?" How does he label Job, especially based on verse 2? What's he call him? Job, you just talk. You just yapping is all you're doing. You're a talkative man. You're a boastful man. What had Job been boasting of? His innocence. But Zophar is saying, what do you mean? I mean, here the three of us sit, speaking from their perspective, and they just know in their mind, because everybody knows, the wisdom of the ancients teaches this, the vision that Eliphaz had teaches this, and they're just convinced that the reason anyone is in your position is again because of what? We're not trying to be redundant, let us keep it before us. Because why? You've sinned. And Job, how can you sit there and with a straight face and keep boasting of your innocence? You're just talkative. And we cannot sit here and let that go unanswered. So now I'm going to speak up. And I'm going to answer you, Job. Each of them trying to convince him to do what they thought he needed to do. Now, he only heard Job's words. I'm convinced of that. He didn't see Job's anguish. He only saw what he said, heard what he said. But he didn't see the man in his suffering. Empathy. We have to be empathic. Have to be. Seems to me. And he accuses Job of maintaining innocence in the face of overwhelming evidence. "For you have said," verse 4, "my teaching is pure, and I am innocent in your eyes." But then look at verse 5. What does Zophar say? "But I wish what would happen, Job?" That's right. What is... Go ahead, Wayne. Yeah. Now, what is Job asked for? He's asked for that meeting for God. And Zophar says, "Well, I'll tell you what, Job. If you really got what you asked for, you wouldn't like what God's going to tell you. Because I'm convinced that God would say to you, Job, here's what you've done that's wrong, and here's why I'm punishing you this way." So it seems that Zophar is really saying to Job, you really don't want to have that meeting with God. You don't want to have that. Because these three men are convinced in their minds that God is on their side of this argument. God would agree with them, not with Job. And Job is equally convinced in his mind, "Well, I want this meeting with God because I know God would show you three that I am not guilty of what you said I'm guilty of, Brother Harold." Yes. That's okay. Yet Job said that he knew God was aware of man's sinfulness. And God would say whether or not Job was actually guilty of sin or not. Yes. That's right. That is correct. Yes, Charles. Yes. That's true. Failing to see, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. Jesus taught that. Absolutely. Absolutely. They were smug in their own theology. So many people are more concerned about theology, theological arguments, than about practicality of religious teaching, how to live it, not just know it. But these three seem to be more concerned about that. So, yes, Job had earlier requested to have such a meeting. But Zophar seems to be saying, Job, I'm telling you, you don't want to do that. Okay. Now, look in verses 7 through 12 of chapter 11. And Zophar, again, he'll add nothing new to the debate. Eliphaz has talked about this. Bildad has talked about this. These are not untrue statements, but they're not helpful to the debate. He expands upon the wisdom of God. It remains, or it resides in heights that man cannot attain to. Oh, yes, that's true. Of course that's true. And no man can restrain God. Look at verse 10. Speaking about God, if God passes by or shuts up or calls an assembly, who can restrain Him? Well, nobody can. For He knows false men. I believe that's an insinuation. In Zophar's mind, who's the false man? Job is, because of his persistent claims of innocence, which is to Zophar and the other two in the face of overwhelming evidence. Yes, Harold? Okay. Yes. That's correct. Harold's in verse 4 of chapter 11, by the way. Yes. Yes, right. Right. Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes, that's correct. So Zophar seems to be trying to put Job's words back on Job and say, now look, Job, it's time for you to do what you've taught other people in the past. And though what your previous statements do not match your present actions, seems to be what he's saying. Don't be the hypocrite. Yes, and we'll get to that point just in a second. Look in verse 12. The day that a donkey gives birth to a man is the day an idiot understands God's wisdom. Now, my version actually says in verse 12, an idiot, a shallow man, a foolish man. What does the New King James say there? Empty-headed. Are there other statements and other translations? We want to get the whole flavor here. But he didn't say, Job, you're an idiot, but I think this is a backhanded accusation. Now, when will a donkey give birth to a human? Never. That's not going to happen. And so he says, the day, like we say, when pigs fly, you know, we'll say that. Well, he says, the day that happens is the day somebody in your position is going to understand God's wisdom. Now, I find this very ironic, and we'll get to this point at the end of Zophar's argument. Basically, they're telling Job, well, let me back up here. Job is saying he wants a meeting with God to gain full understanding of what's happening to him. He wants to know why. The friends are saying, Job, God's wisdom is so far up here, and you're down here. You cannot possibly understand all this. What's the irony in that? But who claims to have understanding? They do. Isn't that ironic? Brother Harold mentioned hypocrisy. That's hypocrisy. They thought they had it all figured out. Are they any better off than Job is? They're not in any better position than Job is. Pardon? Yes, they were worse. Tom says they were worse because of their unfounded accusations. So, he then says to Job in verse 13 and 20, you need to repent. Again, that's what Eliphaz said. That's what Bildad has said. Job, you need to repent. That's what you need to do. Direct your heart right. Spread out your hand to Him. Verse 13. Make yourself like you ought to be. Put your iniquity far away. Verse 14. You see that? And then you could be lifted up. You wouldn't fear. You would forget your trouble. Verses 15 to 16. All this bad would be put behind you. And life would become good again. What kind of blessings was it that Eliphaz and Bildad told Job he would enjoy if he would repent? Physical. Nobody ever said one word about an improved spiritual relationship, an improved standing before God in terms of his soul. They only emphasized your life would get better again. And Eliphaz is saying the same way. All your troubles would be, they'd all go away. They'd all disappear. So again, he's not saying anything new that Job hasn't already heard. You would lie down and none would disturb you. Verse 19, the first part, second part. Many would entreat your favor. Job had earlier said, had he not, that in his former life when times were good, what did people come to Job for what? They came to Job for help, didn't they? He was a counselor and a teacher and an advisor. And Zophar says, now look, if you'll just do this one thing, just repent, then people would again entreat your favor. They'll come to you like they used to. And you'll have this great standing before other men, just like the good old days. You know, we always harken back to the good old days, don't we? And he says, Job, that'll happen to you again if you'll just do this. But now the eyes of the wicked, they're going to fail. Another insinuation. In fact, the only hope for the wicked, as the chapter concludes, is for them to do what? To die. Breathe their last. That's their only hope, is just to breathe their last and get their miserable life over. If they won't straighten up with God. So far, I say he's more biting and more harsh than was Eliphaz or Bildad. And Job had to hear this from him also. Now, quickly reviewing his argument, he's added nothing new to the debate. No great revelation here on his part. And he has been more caustic, more harsh, more biting than was Eliphaz or Bildad. And again, verses 7 through 9, he bluntly told Job that you can't figure all this out, but I'll tell you, we've got it all figured out. So you just need to listen to us. Okay. Anything through chapter 11 that anybody has? I'm doing all the talking today, and I don't like to do it that way. I want to hear what you've got to say so far. Anybody have a comment or question? Yes, Trevor. Yes. Would it be fair to say that the minds of these three men are closed? Are they open to any other way that's the reason behind all this other than just a simple answer that Job's in sin? Their minds are closed. Yes. Yes. In terms of human wisdom, yes. Yes. Right. But obviously, we know that that's not why all this is happening, because we are privy to the first two chapters of the book, and we know why this is happening. It wasn't because Job was in sin.
There's no indication that these people have been, or that Satan has instigated these remarks.
Yes, the devil's using them. I think that's an astute observation. We don't have any textual evidence that Satan sent them to do this, but no doubt they're doing his bidding. Yes, Charles. Very possible. Possibly. Yes. All four want to understand. But I'm certainly convinced that no one wants it more than Job does because he's the one being affected by all this. Okay. Good comments. Now, we get to Job's reply of Zophar. Chapter 12. Given how he begins this reply, to me, this is, to me, one of the more humorous parts of the book. If you can find some humor in the Scripture, there are a few occasions where you kind of chuckle at what's recorded. But I'll tell you what now. Job, I got to give Job his due. He's patient. Man, he takes a lot. Now, he's done some things I don't agree with, but Job takes a lot. Eliphaz has spoken, Bildad has spoken, and then Zophar chimed in. Not a three of them made a bit of sense about any of it. So finally, after Zophar speaks, what does Job say in verse 2 of chapter 12? Boy, when you guys go, there won't be a wise man on the earth. You got all the answers, don't you? He'd had it. Absolutely had it with these three. And again, let's not forget, why did they come? They came to comfort him. That's why they came. But they quit doing that a long time ago. Now they're just popping off. And insinuation upon insinuation. Blatant. Gross misrepresentation. And Job says, when you die, boy, that's the last of the wise men on the earth. What do you think about that response? Can you blame Job? I can't. Try my patience then too. But that's what he says. Things were better when they were quiet. Now after saying that in verse 2, how does Job somewhat defend himself in verse 3? Now listen, you guys, you've not cornered the market on intelligence or wisdom. I'm no dummy. I've got some things figured out myself too. I have intelligence. I have some wisdom. This is not Job being pompous. He's not bragging. He's just saying, you aren't as smart as you think you are. And I've got some faculties of mind. I can figure some things out myself too. So I think we can see up to this point how thoroughly disgusted Job is with his friends up to this point. He's really had it with them in terms of what they've been telling him. Based on their unfounded conclusions and their accusations and insinuations. Verse 3, they are not superior to him. Job had intelligence. I've got insight into matters that happen here on earth just like you do. You see that there in verse 3. I am not inferior to you. Now, verse 4, how does Job... He says, who does not know such these things as these? I mean, you come here to tell me all this, and everybody knows that. How's it any help to me? You're not really, really helping me. Now, how does Job see himself? Verse 4. All right. My version says, Job says, I'm a joke. Now, he didn't mean anything funny by that. He means people see Job as an absolute joke. Other versions have a different word. I'm mocked. I'm a laughingstock. Everybody's making fun of me. Right.
Right.
And what they do, they're picking on him. They're laughing at him, Brother Thompson. His neighbors, they're supposed to be his friends, and they're supposed to help Job, and everybody's laughing at him. Look quickly. We'll look at this some more. Quick ahead to chapter 17 and verse 6. You'll see another reference. And this time it's a little more, it's different than this. He says that God has made him a byword. And I am one at whom men spit. He's blaming God for that. God's done this to me. And also chapter 30, verses 1 and 9 and 10. You'll see, again, similar statements from Job. That I've just become the laughingstock. I'm the town joke. I'm the neighborhood joke. Everybody's, ha, 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 look at Job. Isn't he funny? Isn't he pitiful? I don't have respect anymore among my peers, among people. That's how Job sees himself. We're going to have to quit here just in a second. Our time is gone. So now in verses 5 to 25, great big section of text, Job has just said to the friends, you know, you're no wiser than I am. I've got some things figured out too. And in this section, which we'll pick up, the Lord willing, on Wednesday night, we'll see how Job illustrates and expresses his wisdom, comparatively speaking, to what the friends have said. I appreciate your comments this morning. We'll pick up then in verse 5, which puts us question 5 on page 12 of your handouts. Thank you for your attention.